Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the rye to my Dodd and the devil to my God. Well, okay, I'm going too far there. I'm more Job than God. Well, anyway, it's Dan. How are you doing this very late evening, Dan?
I'm a little wore out from being on vacation for the last week, and my voice might be a little scratchy because I haven't really been talking, you know, other than saying like three words to, gas station clerk or motel, front desk person or whatever. I mean, I really haven't talked out loud for like a week. So if I might sound a little, I might sound like I finally hit puberty a bit. I don't know. Maybe that's too much to expect.
Well, maybe this will be one of your more manly podcasts. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And how are you?
I'm doing okay. Most silly thing that happened today was I was trying to pick a shirt to wear this morning. And I would say 95 to 98% of my wardrobe tends to be graphic t-shirts of some form or another, be it comic book related or movie or what have you. So I just randomly selected one of my favorite older shirts, which is a Columbo shirt, the Peter Falk from Columbo, the great 1970s detective series. You know, it says, just one more thing on it. It didn't occur to me until probably 2 or 3 hours later that I was wearing a Columbo shirt on Columbus Day.
You fuck.
There were people who thought I was like making a little wry little joke there, like, oh, I get it. And I was like, I swear to God, that hadn't even occurred to me. I wish I could have been that funny this morning, but 7:30 in the morning, I'm usually not that funny. It's just one of those weird things that happened. So, but, you know, we go from 7:30 in the morning to where we're closing in on 1 in the morning. But we are here tonight to debut our latest episode-devoted podcast. We are going to be tackling the second season of Fargo. I think we made this decision that we were going to do this several months ago. I think it was like almost a done deal. Okay, definitely when Fargo comes back, we want a podcast about that. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yeah, I'm sure like the second I started watching like the series, once I got the Blu-rays, I'm sure I probably messaged you and said it was time to we'd be doing that. And I don't think we've had much of a fight.
I was a huge fan of Fargo, you know, from the word go last season. As probably a handful of our more devoted listeners will know, we did our best of 2014 show, and that was actually my selection as my favorite television series of 2014. And for anyone who wants to track down that podcast, if you go to, what's our site, STVD for Serious TV Drama Podcast. podbean.com. That's a place you can find all 74, including this one, of our podcasts, and you can track down that one, which I think was late. I'm guessing it must have been late December of last year.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Remember, we did it near the end of the year.
Right. And I know that you needed to catch up on it because you're a much busier person than I am usually, but once you started getting into it, you know, it became a fait accompli that we were going to do this podcast. And then we started hearing about the casting of the show. And every name we heard was like, what? I've got to see this. Nick Offerman, I've got to see that.
And I, for the most part, I'd forgotten about the casting other than Offerman and, a couple others. I'd pretty much forgotten everybody who was in it, just because there's so many different shows, you know, it's hard to keep track of. I mean, nowadays, I mean, they have all sorts of good shows like this where just a ton of great actors or actresses in it. So like, for example, like when I saw Ted Danson, I'm like, holy crap, Ted Danson. Oh yeah, that's right. So it's kind of nice that even though I knew it, you know, I'd forgotten it.
Yeah. Even someone like me who tends to log all this stuff in my memory banks pretty easily, there were a couple people I was like, oh, I didn't know. I didn't even know that person was on this. Like, you know, like I can't pronounce her name, but the person who plays Betsy Salverson, Christine I wrote it down and now I forgot what her name is. Melody, whatever. She actually played the person that turned out to be the mother on How I Met Your Mother. Although I was like, really? She's going to play two different mothers that are both dying? But I didn't know she was on it, and she was lovely on this. But it was a bunch of cast members I didn't realize were on this, so I was very pleased about that.
Yeah.
So, now, it was the first season, you know, it took place back in 2006. And, you know, other than a very minor plot point, I mean, almost an inconsequential plot point, it had really little else to do with the 1996 film, you know? But, you know, way back when, you know, I was the one watching it, you hadn't gotten back to, you know, we couldn't have really podcasted about it at the time anyway, because that's right when we started our podcast on Mad Men, was when Fargo had debuted. So we were just learning how to podcast at that time. We're such experts now. But in that first season, we were introduced to that local cafe or diner owner, Lou Salverson, who was the father of the lead, Deputy Molly Salverson. He was definitely one of the instantly likable characters on that show because he was played with like real warmth and humor and that little touch of gravitas we like to attach to older actors. I think it was Keith Carradine who played him.
Yep.
And, you know, they established in that season that he was a retired lawman himself. And throughout that season, he kept making these references to this Sioux Falls massacre. So once we heard that they were going to do a second season, we were going to follow that character, but going way back to 1979, you know, one of the things we're going to be looking forward to happening this season is finally seeing the so-called Sioux Falls massacre and just seeing how far they can go. Because they've made it really clear it was like a horrific bloodbath. And it wasn't apparently what happened in tonight's episode. So I'm very curious to see just how bad it could possibly have been. So the other thing I did want to mention before we get into the nuts and bolts of the episode, we like to, you know, tip our hat and credit the people behind the scenes who are responsible for these shows. Like when we talk about Mad Men, we probably mention Matthew Weiner on probably every episode, right? And when we talked about Better Call Saul, we tended to mention Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould quite often because, you know, these are creators and writers and they're other than the actors, they're responsible for what we're hearing and seeing on screen. We should probably do the same for Fargo. The creator and writer of the series, his name is Noah Hawley. And I just want to, like, you know, wave my hands in the air like I'm bowing before him because he has pulled off yet another great job with this episode, creating this entire slew of characters and story threads, which the way this episode is broken up, it's kind of like we're introduced to like a different set of characters in each act as the episode proceeds along. At least the first several were like that, I thought. Then they all kind of come together later on. But I thought that was a nice way of compartmentalizing the episode and being able to follow who people were and what was going on.
Yeah, I like the way they did it. It's good format and just kind of matter of fact. You know, here's what it is. You know, not really ramming anything down your throat, just letting you kind of get used to the new lay of the land at whatever pace you want.
And again, although it's, you know, not really, doesn't have really much of a connection to the original film beyond, you know, similar locations and you may hear the occasional accent you recognize, it does, just like the first season, share that sort of similar tone where I kind of think of the first season, this episode and the movie, they're very, 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 very dark comedies, you know,
yeah.
Which is by far my wheelhouse of preferred entertainment. I love something which is twisted, will make you laugh and also horrify you at the same time. And they do a really good job with these Fargo episodes so far.
And, you know, I was watching and seeing the commercials from some of the other FX shows and just, like, thinking, well, you know, like, I mean, this show is, you know, and last season could be pretty, you know, pretty out there, pretty violent. And but it's never, like, just cheap, stupid crap like Sons of Anarchy, for example. You know, it's not, I mean, it can be, I guess it can be gratuitous, but it's not just, like, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but, well, whatever the way they're doing it, they're just wrapping it in, you know, a shroud of, like, coolness that just makes it not just feel like they're just, you know, cheap douchebags looking for a cheap thrill.
Yeah, I mean, while there are some things that may be done, quote-unquote, for effect, but it's effective, and it's done for a reason. And there's also the difference between something like Fargo and, say, let's say Sons of Anarchy, but perhaps use your example. And it's this kind of credit for this goes to the director and the cinematographer of the show. There is a certain odd beauty to the violence also, the aftermath, whether it be seeing the blood mixed with a milkshake or the arterial spray after someone's been gunned down in the snow or something. There's always something. It's almost appealing to the eye, even if it's horrific as well. So I very much appreciate many aspects of this show. The first season, of course, which, you know, won many Emmys and deserved them all. And hopefully this, what we're seeing right now.
Right. Yeah, it kind of like has the same vibe. It's like a, you know, for me, like a Tarantino film. Not that I'm a huge fan of those, for the most part, but, you know, I can still watch it and, you know, see a bloodbath, but appreciate it for just, like, you know, just kind of being, I don't know, not lame.
Right, not lame is usually the way to go when you want to be appealing. I mean, yeah, there's a tradition of beautifully orchestrated violence from Sam Peckinpah to Quentin Tarantino and so on and so forth. And although I wouldn't say the Fargo TV show goes to those extremes because it's not going to be wall-to-wall violence. When they do go there, I think it's kind of in that tradition, much like the original movie was. I mean, like the infamous wood chipper scene and things like that. So, with all that preambling aside, I guess we should start to delve into the episode itself.
Yeah.
So I got to say, was kind of thrown for a little bit of a loop, at least for a good 30 to 60 seconds, when it opened with the old MGM logo. And it had a very silly and rather humorous opening. It looked like it was like an outtake from the filming of a movie called, of course, Massacre at Sioux Falls, starring Ronald Reagan. And we're just subjected to this silly conversation between one of the people on the set who may be the director or something. They don't really clarify who that person is. And he's talking to the American Indian who's there. And they're waiting for Ronald Reagan to finish getting all the arrows stuck in him to get ready for the scene. So right off the bat, the title of the episode, which is Waiting for Dutch, we see that in the opening because Dutch was Ronald Reagan's famous nickname. So it's kind of weird because I'm like, okay, that can't really be why it's called Waiting for Dutch. Yeah, I think there's more of a metaphor at work here, but it did make for a very bizarre and amusing opening. Just like the film and also last season, they love to wink at us. They again begin the season by telling us that this is a true story and the names have been changed to protect the survivors. And out of respect for the dead, the rest will remain as it happened. The funny thing is, I actually remember back in the 90s where that was actually a minor, very minor controversy with Fargo, because there were people going, wait, this is a true story? And like, no, it's not really a true story. They're just having a little fun with us.
Oh yeah, I like how the music for the Western Sioux City Massacre was like an old school Western version of the Fargo theme.
Yes. I caught that. I thought that was great. I thought that was very funny that they got away with that. And in that opening, right after they talk about, you know, things being a true story, well, we do see a couple things that are true, because we're treated to a little bit of a, I would say like a 1970s montage. Oh, you know, where we see scenes of Jimmy Carter speaking and gas lines and John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy. But like I said, at least the first few acts, we're introduced to different sets of characters. And in the first act here, the main folks that we meet are members of the Gerhardt family. We're initially introduced to a couple brothers. One of the first people we meet is Jeffrey Donovan's character, Dodd Gerhardt. He seems like quite the piece of work, shall we? Like I imagine we're going to see him do unspeakable violent things to other characters eventually on the show, because he looks like he's the muscle of the family more so than anybody else. I got a kick out of this because I did watch Burn Notice, and I always liked Jeffrey Donovan on that show, and he did have fun playing different characters or aliases on that show, but here he really looks like more of a force to be reckoned with. We also meet his younger brother, who's kind of a schmuck, Rye Gerhardt. And based on their conversation, we get the impression that we're going to be following a crime family who's got some competition that they're trying to find out about. When we are later at the Gerhardt family complex or home, talk about people I did not know were going to be on the show. I bet you got excited for a moment there. When we saw Battlestar Galactica's Michael Hogan show up as the patriarch of the family, Otto Gerhardt.
Yeah, the only thing in my notes that's all caps is just the word Saul. So
it was nice to see him without an eye patch.
Yeah.
Because I've seen him on two things, BSG and Smallville, and on both he wore eye patches. So I started to think, does he just wear eye patches in all his roles? So I was glad to see him not have an eye patch here.
What kind of character did he play in Smallville?
You know, it's funny you should ask that, since you watched season 2 of Arrow. Smallville did their own version of Slade Wilson, but nothing like the way Slade Wilson, aka Deathstroke, should be or would be. So that was the character he played.
Nice.
Yeah, ridiculous. it wasn't one of their better moves, in my opinion. So, like I mentioned Rye Gerhardt, and this is Kieran Culkin, one of the many acting Culkins who are better than Macaulay, quite frankly. It's one of those characters who it's a little bit of a cliche, but you don't mind it if it works, because there's always like the younger schmucky brother. You know, it reminded me of like that character like from season 2 of The Wire, where it's the younger brother who's kind of a schmuck and he's got ambition, but you know he's going to screw up. You know he's going to do something which is going to screw everything up.
And I really like the way they played on that too. Just like every time they had any kind of like scene with him, like they made the music all super loud and super dramatic, like just, you know, pretty much just to like, you know, just to be weird. But
and also because you knew like, okay, yeah, something bad is going to happen because of this kid. You were just waiting for it. So we see that he ends up talking to some not so smooth, like a huckster type of a dude, who is trying to make a deal with him that, you know, they can arrange to be like the sole distributors of this new self-correcting IBM electric typewriter.
Yeah, you know who that actor was? He looked really familiar.
You know, I neglected to look up who that actor was, and it occurred to me during the episode, but I just didn't get around to looking him up. So that might be something we look up for the next episode, because I do think we're going to see him again.
Yeah.
But we find out in this little scene between the two of them that him making this little side deal with Rye, because, you know, again, he's ambitious. He wants to do things. He wants to make money. If he can get his family to forgive this dude's gambling debts, and then someone needs to talk to a judge that apparently has frozen this guy's financial assets. And from that point on, we end up watching Rye in pursuit of this female judge. I don't know what else to call her because I do not think we're ever given her name.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool the way they shot that scene too, with them, you know, with just the way they kept making those cuts. Yeah. And they weren't like, you know, any, you know, long delayed cuts, and, you know, obviously it's a, you know, style choice. It goes back into the old days, but it was really fun.
Right. And one thing right off the bat we noticed in the first several minutes of this episode were they are doing different things cinematography wise now. Like, they're doing a lot of split screens, you know, which is pretty awesome. And it does, I don't know why, but it does seem to evoke the times. It seems like the kind of thing I would have seen in, like, a lot of really cool 70s movies or something. So it really is fitting with the show, more so than if they had done that in the 2006 era season.
Yeah, and it's definitely, you know, it's a bit over the top, but as long as they keep writing the show well, I mean, go ahead and be over the top.
Yeah, I don't mind it. I'm not expecting Fargo to be terribly subtle. So, you know, as long as they're doing it in a really entertaining and well-written fashion, I don't mind. Do as you will. So he ends up following that judge to, I thought of you, follows her to a Waffle Hut. But before he goes in, he cokes up. I love this whole thing. He tries to threaten her, but she pretty much regards him like a bug, just the way she treats him. I do appreciate that she first tries to tell him the story of Job, you know, the whole deal between the bet between God and the devil and the screwing with Job, whatever. But it's pretty clear that Rye is pretty much a dim bulb. So she just sprays his face with bug spray. I like that she just happens to have this huge canister of bug spray, which is kind of unexplained, but, you know, okay, that's fine. Maybe she did some shopping in between trials at headquarters or something. I don't know.
I've got a funny anecdote for you that actually I haven't told you about yet. Earlier this morning when I was on my way back from Colorado and stuff, I jokingly made some comment about I should stop in Sioux Falls on my way through because I drove through there and do some research for the podcast. And then by the time you got back to me, I was already gone. Well, but when you got back to me, I was actually in that town that this Waffle Hut takes place in, Laverne, Minnesota. Like, that's where I actually, like, was. And so it was like, it's too late for me to do research. I was actually, like, in that town driving down the main drag. So it's a fun coincidence.
If only you had stopped in the Waffle Hut, that would have been really. Of course, I'm not sure that Waffle Hut actually exists.
Yeah, it probably does.
But we like to imagine it does. So the bug spray leads to bad things. Because he shoots her, and then things just get crazier from that point on. And it's shot with, you know, there's some slow motion going on here. There's some interesting cross-cutting because the cook comes charging out and he shoots her. And then the waitress freaks out and drops a coffee pot. And then he shoots her. And then the judge stabs him. And then he horrifically blows her away. And that's when we get that moment of seeing, like, her blood mixing with her milkshake on the table, which is kind of pretty.
Yeah.
It was just like the violence just kept going and going and going. And then it becomes comical when he's trying to pull that knife out of his back. And it's at that point, once he's able to do that, the waitress tries to get away. She kind of limps out the door. So he pursues her and he's out of bullets. So it's really rather, it's both funny and horrible at the same time that he has to go through all the trouble of reloading his gun and then he's still able to, well, blow her head off.
The who's the actress that played the judge? She looked familiar. Do you know where I would recognize her from?
No, I did not recognize her.
Okay. By the end of the episode, I realized that that Saul's wife was I couldn't place her. Then I realized that she was like the actress that plays the president's wife in one of the better seasons of 24.
Jean Smart. Yeah, she's probably best known from being from Designing Women. But yeah, she was also the president's wife. Or wasn't she like the evil wife?
I don't know. Everybody was evil in that season.
That's true. Let's get back to the scene, because what happens right now maybe is possibly the most inexplicable thing in the entire episode. I actually wrote, it just got weird. Right after he's blown the waitress's head off, he looks off into the woods, and there's these lights. I kept thinking they're initially going to seem weird or like something out of, well, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, but then they're going to be revealed to be something perfectly
Snowmobile or something.
It's never explained that they just come out of the trees and just shoot down the highway into the horizon. And I went, wait, they just went Close Encounters on us, and they're not going to. I mean, I would assume that somehow we're going to get an explanation for that. Although it would be kind of funny if they never explained. That would be really funny. I mean, people are like, but wait a minute, what were those lights?
Well, yeah, I mean, that definitely was like the Close Encounters like style UFO. So, I mean, I suppose it would make sense if, like, you know, this coming up or this taking place relatively close after closing. Close Encounters came out. So if he's all coked out and have an ulcer, but I don't know if people really trip out like that when they're on coke or whatever he was on.
If I'm remembering correctly, in 1979, I think at that point, Close Encounters might have gotten its re-release of its like its special edition or something. I seem to have this memory it was around that time, like a year or so later after its original release. So, but him being transfixed by these flying lights leads to him getting smashed. Which I love that we're watching something which I was not expecting any of this. I didn't know the plot of this season or whatever. And it wasn't what struck me as even funnier wasn't the fact that he gets hit by a car. But then we just see the car just slowly start to pull away with him on the hood. And he was, you know, stuck in the windshield. I was like, wait, what's happening here? But I remember thinking, like, okay, that was quite the opening act to an episode, because I don't know what the hell just happened. But when we come back, that's when we finally get to meet the younger Lou Salverson, you know, local lawman, and he's reading a story to his daughter Molly. So we know that's the little girl who will be the main character in season one. The reason I felt I needed to mention that is I love the fact that they put this little gag in there. He's reading her a bedtime story, and he reacts to the fact that a children's book uses the word ejaculate, or ejaculate, I should say. Because it's like, why would the author have chosen that word? Did the author not have a thesaurus? This is a children's book. You didn't need to say ejaculate. And I like that they don't make a big deal about it. You just see his face, and you realize like who wrote this? What?
And I didn't until later in the episode when I was realizing how the actress who played his wife was like cast really well to like, you know, look like somebody that could be the Molly's mother after watching season one. But like I like completely didn't even like put two and two together like that kid was like, you know, all that's Molly until like later in the episode. So I'm just like, duh.
Right. And I think they did make a point back in season one where when they talk about Molly, they talk about how she takes after her mother. She's got that same kind of spirit or inquisitive nature. So I like that we got to see a little bit of that with the character of her mother, Betsy Salverson. So, however, it was pretty sad because once he says to her, how did your thing go today? Did you have your thing today? I already knew, okay, she already looks a little, what's the word, wan or wan?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, and you pick up later on when they actually say it outright that she's got cancer of some form. So that might be why we never see her mother in season one. She probably passed away many years earlier due to cancer, I would assume.
Yeah, and Patrick Wilson definitely does a, you know, kick-ass job getting Keith Carradine's like cadence like down just perfectly, because I mean if you close your eyes you could just I don't even know if you could tell the two apart, so it's pretty sweet.
Right, absolutely. I think maybe as he got older he probably speaks in a somewhat more laconic way, but that actually makes sense because when people get older that sometimes their speech patterns will slow down a little. I would say, watch like Clint Eastwood in his 40s and then watch Clint Eastwood like in his 70s or something like that, and you'll see his manner of speech tends to slow down. The rest of the scene is kind of neat because we're watching Lou investigate the crime scene. We see this truck driver is kind of a schmuck there. But more importantly, we also get to meet Hank Larson, who is a state police officer and also Lou's father-in-law.
I got the impression that he was a local police officer and Lou is the state patrolman.
See, I thought it was the other way around.
No,
I think the father is the state guy and Lou is the local guy. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, Trooper is aware of that kind of hat that Lou wears. So, and then I recognize the kind of car too. I mean, I saw three or four. Obviously, they're newer, but that's like the way the state trooper cars look now. Still, so the red and gold. So, Ted Danson's character is definitely I got the impression he's probably the sheriff of Laverne or whatever. Because I figured if they're just name dropping somebody got shot at the Waffle Hut, that's probably where they live. But I'm pretty sure that I got the cop stuff right anyway.
All right, no, you probably are. I almost wish I could go rewatch the scene because I thought the point of the scene was that state didn't want it, local was going to take it, which meant Patrick Wilson was going to take it, but maybe I misunderstood that. So either way, I'll assume that you're correct based on the facts you've presented until proven otherwise. So I'll agree with you because I'd rather agree with you and find out that you're wrong than stick to my guns and prove myself.
Yeah.
But what I like about this scene is, and one of the great things about this show and this episode is we're getting plot and we're getting character and we're seeing how this relationship, what the status of their relationship is, how they act towards each other. I like the fact that they're both they're smart and methodical, but they're not unrealistically so. You know, they're not like instant geniuses who are able to put everything together like you would see on certain TV shows, which may be good TV shows, but it really wouldn't fit here. But they're not country bumpkins either, you know, which could have been a different kind of cliche they could have went with here. So I like that about this scene.
Oh yeah, the town where the waffle hut is, it's like 20-25 minutes away from Sioux Falls. So just in case anybody was wondering, how long the judge was driving to get a good waffle, it's about that far.
Okay. And speaking of odd or silly things, the scene does end with them, especially Ted Danson's character. Again, his character name is Hank Larson. I always try to make a point of making an effort to remember the character names at the beginning, and then we'll see how often we refer to them by their actors' names or the character names. We're trying to refer to them by character names whenever possible. It might be tough for someone like Ted Danson because it's easy just to call him Ted Danson, I think.
Yeah.
But there is that moment at the end where he notices that there's a shoe in the tree and kind of wondering how it got there. And I got to think that shoe has a bit more importance than I might have initially thought when I saw it in a trailer for the show. I don't know if the shoe could have flown out of the car that crashed into Rye earlier somehow, but who knows? Maybe it did. But I got a feeling that shoe means something.
I think I'm pretty sure it's one of Rye's shoes, I think, because it looked like when him and Todd are fighting later in the episode, and then his body falls to the floor. It looks like he's wearing one of them.
That would make a lot of sense. Good catch. Yeah. So now the next act of the show, because I've done with other things, I like to separate these episodes into acts. It's a bit more of a character act. Not really much in the way of plot, it's more a character, because we need to be introduced to some more important players for the season. And most importantly, we meet Ed and Peggy Blomquist, who are, as you, Jesse Clemens, who, as you mentioned, a lot of people remember as Todd from Breaking Bad. Some might remember him from Friday Night Videos as well. Friday Night Lights, wow, Friday Night Videos, wow. It's 1:50 in the morning. Give me a break. And Peggy is Kirsten Dunst, who has decided to do TV, which is good for her. I like when we meet them in this act, they seem like perfectly decent, simple people. They're praying before their little dinner of hamburger helper and tater tots. And that's really all we see of them. They seem like just a perfect, nice little couple, which means we're going to see something really bad with them. and then we also go to, I guess, it's the local bingo hall or something, a scene I didn't know we were going to get in this first episode, where Lou meets up with, I guess, his friend and conspiracy nut, Carl Weathers. I love that his name is – I know they don't mention the show, but I looked up – I love the character's name is Carl Weathers because folks might know Carl Weathers as the actor and boxer from the Rocky movies. It's Carl with a K. I'm hoping we'll see a lot more of him. That's Nick Offerman, sans mustache, but with other enough other
fish. He's got some amazing chops going on there.
There's also some other guy there. Character's name is Sonny Greer. He's just some schlemiel that I guess Carl just tells his stories to. I don't know if he'll
understand. Yeah, I definitely like seeing Offerman just like playing like a kind of like this, almost, you know, the same character we're used to seeing on Parks and Rec, just like Mr. like, you know, thinks the government's just completely like out to get everybody and that kind of thing.
Well, they're definitely both anti-government characters.
Right.
I don't recall if his character on Parks and Rec was much of a conspiracy guy. I don't know if he really had any patience for people like that either. But, you know, it has been a while, so maybe he was into that. But either way, it's fun seeing Nick Offerman. And almost shocking to see him on a show like this, so it's kind of great that we do.
Yeah.
And we established that he's not just friends with Lou Salverson, but he knows his wife. He's very angry and upset that she has cancer. And he even makes a reference to John McCain about how if he was able to, you know, survive like 5.5, you know, years being tortured and held prisoner, you know, by the Viet Cong and whatever, that hopefully she'll be able to kick cancer's ass just as easily or something like that. But when we go back to the Salverson home, and that's when we see just how, you know, sharp and witty she really is with him, and talking about the murders and whatever. I think at this point, just knowing about her cancer just makes these scenes feel that much more tragic, because we know that, you know, that she's probably going to pass away as a result of it. It was a very light act in that sense, or it was very short, because that was pretty much it for Act 3. And I remember thinking, wow, there was like virtually no plotting there. That's because Act 4, we get a whole lot of plotting. that really nice couple, the sweet Blomquists. Well, we go back to dinner with them. And we find out some, you know, fun little facts about them. You know, she's getting into the thing called LifeSpring, which at the time, that was one of those new agey, those like wellness centers. They're all about, you know, bettering yourself and realizing your full potential. Those things kind of started in the mid-70s, and they were quite popular at that time. But the unfortunate thing here we find out is, get the impression these two don't have sex very often. And I don't think Ed's too happy about it. I'm not gonna say Ed's dumb, but I would just say he's a very simple man, you know. And he clearly loves his wife and is probably just devoted to her and just will go along with anything she says, as we'll see later in the scene, certainly. But you know, it's kind of unfortunate because he clearly would like to get with his wife, and he wouldn't mind having a baby. Because I think he even points out, you know, they can't really have a baby if they hardly have sex. But I like it. All of a sudden he hears like a thud and a thump, like coming from, I guess it's the garage. And all of a sudden she wants to do it. But it's, she just wants to distract him. And I'm so stupid, it didn't even occur to me until he opened the door, like she was the one who hit Rye with the car.
Well, yeah, I thought maybe like the first couple bumps, I thought maybe that she was like banging somebody else, and that's why she wasn't giving him any. But and then the third one, it's like, ah, sounds like it's a garage.
So he puts on that light, and then we see like the huge, hole in the windshield and the blood streaks on the car. And, she's claiming it was a deer, but, we know she's the driver that smashed into Rye. The fact that we heard all the thumping made her lie that much more ridiculous, because obviously he's somewhere in that room. And yeah, Rye, he's still alive, and he attacks Ed, who ends up stabbing him in the gut with like one of these different gardening tools, I think, that were laying around the garage there. So in a way, they kind of both kill him. She starts and he finishes it. And then we get I love this. We get flashes. We see the immediate aftermath of that accident. It's like his head poking through the windshield and the blood dripping from his skull and pooling on the passenger seat. I like that Ed is just incredulous, although he doesn't really question it much more after that. That she just came home and made dinner. You made hamburger helper. But this is the part I really liked, that she's telling us, or telling him, that she panicked. But as using excellent use of flashback, what we see is quite the opposite. She's not panicking at all in those scenes. She seems very calmly, looking through her mail or something as she's walking away from the garage and seeing the little spot on her shirt and removing it or whatever. I think this is the point where I realize, she's not right. She's not the sweet woman we thought she was. So then she suggests that maybe that they run and to California. And we get to see this little postcard on her mirror that indicates this is probably some sort of a long-standing dream of hers to leave Minnesota for like sunny California or something like that. But he won't do that. But she does convince him that they're going to have to clean it up because, like I said before, I think he'd go along with anything she said other than pulling up sticks and moving to California because, he's got dreams of that running that butcher shop. And they show us a couple of times just everyone saying, okay then. But I would say my main character takeaway from this whole, huge plot point in the episode is, okay, she can be quite the calculating person, quite frankly. I don't know how smart she is, but she's definitely smart enough to, because she's kind of stupid thinking she can just have the guy in her garage like that. But she's definitely the calculating one of the two. And Ed, he's kind of sad. There's something very sad about him, I think. So what did you think of these two? I mean, these are two actors we've seen in very different roles before. So it's kind of interesting to see them in parts like this. I mean, since I feel like these are going to be two that we're going to be following for a lot of the story, and whether we're going to feel sorry for them or not, they tricked us in season one with a character we thought we were going to feel sorry for, and then it turned out we don't. So I'm wondering if they might pull something similar to that with these two.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do. I definitely liked how they have Jesse Plemons all kind of fattened up like they did Lee in one of the seasons of Battlestar Galactica, where he just, just looks all poofy and weird and just looks uncomfortable like the whole time. But then this couple definitely, has a look and feel of like somebody in that part of, Minnesota would look and act, especially back then. But I mean, it feels somebody that's surrounded by people like this, it feels authentic. So it's always nice, you watch a lot of New York TV shows and stuff like that. If you see something that's just completely like off the wall, just that wouldn't freaking happen here, it pulls you out. So it's nice that they take a little time and make it just feel, I was just there today. Nice, and nothing that felt out of place. So it's good.
Right. One of the things I really love about the show, even more so, and I actually would even say they probably get it better in the first season and what we've seen in this one episode than they even did in the film, was they get things right. You can tell that there's a very careful attention to detail. And it's not just about dialects. It's about clothing. It's about the details in a home. It's about the way people talk to each other and act towards each other. You have characters which, on one hand, could be seen as almost cartoons or caricatures, but yet they're made real by the actors and by the quality of the writing. And that's why I think I really love season one so much, and I'm already way on board for this first episode of season two.
And the way they set the set designs are just great too. I mean, in my part-time job, I do inspections, houses and stuff. And, you know, I go in a lot of older homes and stuff. And I mean, that's what these, like, you know, 60s and 70s houses look like. I mean, so it just kind of like, you know, just feels right. Just like, you know, like the scene when she was finishing up dinner or whatever, and had her weird, bizarre pile of, like, magazines or whatever it was that she, like, wouldn't move for him. It reminded me of think of Mad Men. You look at that set and just, like, when you're looking at it, and it's just nice. I mean, we weren't really worried about them screwing up something like that, but still, it's nice to have the, you know, confirmation that they're paying that nice attention to detail, which, you know, I appreciate so much.
Well, yeah, it's great because it's all these things are all about character, you know, whether it be the decor of their house or just her having that pile of magazines and what it represents to her. And no, don't that that's his usually that's his seat. That's his dinner table seat. And the fact that she has her pile of magazines take precedence and can you just take this seat kind of already gives you an indication of who's got the power in this relationship and how she regards their lives together. It's a very telling little thing. I love when movies or television series can do that because it's a very smart writing decision. It's shorthand and it tells you so much without you realizing it.
It's a little odd and quirky like Fargo should be, but then there's just like no exposition needed and just bam, you got the relationship dynamic down, just like, you know, poof right away, and it really informs like the rest of their scenes. So
right, like with these two, they don't spend time as far as exposition is concerned. As far as the past, the only exposition we get is actually future, as far as what their aspirations are, what he sees may happen a year down the road. But they don't need to go over everything that's happened before, beyond the fact that we know that they're not having sex very often or something. No, the only exposition is like the previous weekend, quite frankly. So when we get to the final act of the episode, and even though this episode ran from 10 to 1109, It kind of seemed to blow by. I mean, the only reason it took me long to watch is because I stopped to take notes. But when I realized this was the final, I was like, wait, that's it? I thought we were like halfway through the episode already. So we kind of bounce from a couple different things. We initially see Lou Salverson and his wife just going to sleep. And it's just like a sweet little moment there when we realize, oh, this is the sweet couple. Not those other two, because they're just saying, you know, good night. You know, I think they say good night, Mr. Salverson, good night, Mrs. Salverson, or something like that. It's very sweet. But then we switch from that family to the Gerhardt family, also around the bedside. They do an interesting thing here. The audio essentially is, I think we essentially hear about the death of Otto Gerhardt while we're watching them all around his bedside. So that was kind of an interesting, kind of like seeing two things happen at the same time. It was kind of interesting the way they did that. And also while the two sons and the mother, who's, oh, by the way, the mother's name is Floyd. I didn't know a woman could be named Floyd, but you know, there are women named Michael. So I guess Floyd is just as possible, whatever. But while we're seeing that, we're also seeing those that other not so happy couple packing their youngest son, Rye, in their freezer. And then we get the final scene. And this was one of the actors I did know was going to be in the episode. I was kind of wondering when he was going to show up. It's Brad Garrett, as his character. His name is Joe Bulow. And he's having a slide presentation. It's for the Kansas City Northern Expansion Strategy. It's a whole prospectus meeting, you know? And then which is like, I've sat through many a business meeting in my life. They look like that, although there's usually there's a few lights on. But then you realize, no, this is the mob competition, because they're talking about the Gerhards, and that's how we get our little family history about them. You know, who was the original patriarch, and then how Otto took over from his father. And then we find out how Otto had a stroke the other day. Well, of course, we knew that already. One of the things I really enjoyed here was the shadowy figure, who is probably the person in charge, but we can't clearly see him. He asks, who's in charge now? And Joe says, well, you've got Floyd. That's the Jean Smart character. You know, she's tough. But, she's a girl, which beyond being sexist, it's also kind of funny referring to someone who they clearly make out to look like she's probably in her late 50s or 60s and referring to as a girl. And then you got these three sons, and I think they're all named. So if you didn't know what their names were before, their names are Dodd, Bear, and Rye, who is dead. Apparently they're all going to be vying for the throne, at least in Joe's opinion. So they figured this is the perfect time for them to move in. And, well, if they don't comply and let them take over, well, then they will liquidate. And at that point, that shadowy boss approves. And all of a sudden, oh my gosh, the episode is over. That was it. Done. I wanted another 20 minutes. It's FX. I thought all the shows ran like 90 minutes.
just about.
Just Kurt Suter shows. So, what did you think of this?
I was pleased. I knew I would like it. I didn't know what to expect because I haven't been digging into it too much. And, I watched the one trailer, I think, that you sent me and a few other stuff. But I was I'm definitely all aboard. I can't wait to see what kind of we know that the situation is going to devolve into something that's, really, really crazy and enough to, make Lou a little less than happy to recall it 25 years later-ish.
And constantly recall it also.
So. Yeah, it definitely brings it up, several times. So it'd be interesting to see, just how the situation spirals out of control.
Right. Well, yeah, you can tell that things are going to spiral out of control on this show. I mean, I think that was a big thing in the first season, and we're going to see it happen again here. I am curious about the whole Sioux Falls massacre, because probably one of the best moments and quiet moments in season one was that scene between Keith Carradine and Billy Bob Thornton. So basically between Salverson and Malvo. When he actually asked him if he thinks he'd seen him before and asked him if he had ever been in Sioux Falls. I like that there could somehow be a connection, even though I was like, well, how old could he possibly have been in 1979 to possibly be that guy? But I think similar to you, I also didn't read very much about this season plot-wise. I knew the actors that were going to be in it, and I knew that we were going to be connecting with the younger version of Lou Salverson. And I think I did know that Jean Smart was going to be like the head of some crime family. That was essentially what I knew. And I decided to try not to spoil myself for a change. So I had no idea what was going to happen with Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons. I think I called him Clemens earlier. Plemons' plot or any of that stuff. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
The actor looks like he bulked up a lot, so maybe he did some steroids like Clemens. I don't know.
He definitely looks thicker. I have no idea whether that was done for the show or he just happens to have gained some weight. I have no idea. But I am looking forward to this season. I'm looking forward to podcasting about it. I'm looking forward to laughing and being horrified. I will confess, I did watch the little scenes from, future episodes, and it just all looked crazy and zany. And there are some characters that were going to interact with each other. I'm like, oh no. Because again, when you're watching a show that's, you know, an anthology, single season series kind of a deal, anyone can die. I mean, except the only person who can't die on the show is Lou Salverson and his daughter. Everyone else is fair game. So I won't say what it is because I don't even want to unintentionally spoil anything. There's one moment I'm watching in that little future episodes trailer, and I'm like, oh, no, no, no. I hope they're not going to kill that character. I want that character to be on the show the whole time. I don't even want to go into IMDb and see if they're listed for all 10 episodes or not.
I'm looking forward to it too, and I'm just interested to see if they try to top any of their like really big crazy set pieces from the first season and how they would do that, you know, like the firefight during the blizzard, or even like the weird quirky stuff like the fish tornado or any of that other stuff. So, you know,
let's hope for more stuff that's in the same league as the snowstorm firefight, and maybe less stuff like the fish tornado. That was probably the one aspect of the season, and not even the event of that. I read an explanation for it. I was like, okay, whatever. But that one plot line that kind of ends up going nowhere compared to like almost everything else on the show. They kind of, the whole Oliver Platt storyline in season one kind of, it's kind of like they decided at a certain point, yeah, we don't really know what we're going to do with this, so let's just do this. But, you know, it was so entertaining up until an unsatisfactory ending, but there was so much other great stuff on the show I didn't care, so it was still like an A-plus show for me. So maybe it's just as well that wasn't so good, because if it had been that good, my mind would have just exploded, because the show's too good, too good.
Yeah, it'll all make sense once they, I'm sure they're going to tie the fish tornado into the alien, so once we figure out what their plan was, it'll all come around. And season three can take place in like 2073 Minnesota or something, like it's just a frozen wasteland.
Isn't it always?
It is.
All right, well, I'm glad we were able to come together and knock this one out. I was a little surprised. I thought we weren't going to get to this till later in the week, so I'm glad we've already resumed our almost immediately after schedule like we did with Better Call Saul. So hopefully we'll have as much fun with these Fargo episodes as we did with Better Call Saul. So
I suspect we will. It doesn't seem like the kind of situation where we're going to have to, like, you know, get on Skype and just be like, oh, what the fuck were they doing this week? Oh, that was crap. Oh, damn it. It just doesn't seem to be like that. It's just the kind of thing, just like, you know, get together, talk with your friend about good TV. And doesn't feel like work that way.
Well, speaking of getting together with your friends to talk about TV, look at that. I found a segue. If you'd like to get together with a bunch of Facebook friends and talk about TV, you can do it on our page, the Serious TV Drama Podcast. That's the way you can look us up. You can join the page, join the conversation. There's usually show threads about any number of shows, everything from The Walking Dead to Flash to, of course, Fargo. You can also follow us on Twitter. I would encourage folks to do that, because the more followers we have, the more I feel like it wasn't a waste of time to create a Twitter account, quite frankly. Our Twitter account is at STVD, as in Serious TV Drama, Podcast. That's also, well, actually, you wouldn't find us that way on iTunes. You'd have to type in Serious TV Drama. But if you just type that in the search box, you'll find our podcast there. You can subscribe to us through iTunes. And if you like this podcast or any of our others, we would love it if you could throw us a rating and a review, preferably of the 5-star, you really, really, really like us variety. Have I hit all the important social media notes? We don't have an Instagram account, and I don't think that's going to happen. So we only have our individual ones, which are basically Dan touring the world and me taking pictures of crap I sell on the weekends.
Yes, you have good pictures of good crap and maybe some Urban Decay photos every now and then, or interesting graffiti. Mine's just pictures of slices of pizza and mountains, deserts.
Well, I think we can call it a night then. And until we are going to be getting together a couple more times this week to catch up with our more seriously geeky podcast, where we talk about Flash and Arrow and other comic book related TV shows. But for folks who are tuning in or downloading to hear shows, this one, hopefully we will get this out in a timely fashion and for the rest of the season. But we will be making an effort to get these out, you know, in the wee hours, Monday or Tuesday, unless, you know, real life gets in the way. But hopefully that won't happen, at least for the rest of this year.
Yeah, I'm still on mountain time, so I'm not as tired as I normally am. You know, for me, it's, you know, I've spent the last week, you know, an hour before this, so 2 hours off from you, so I don't feel too bad right now. So hopefully I can get all this editing shit done.
So so even though you're not going to go right off to sleep, I'm still going to say goodnight to you, Dan.
Goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, everybody.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Go to sleep, you little babe.
Your mama's gone away and your daddy's gonna stay. Don't leave nobody but the baby. Go to sleep, you little babe.
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 Everybody's gone in the cotton and the corn. Didn't leave nobody but the baby. Your sweet little babe,
your sweet little babe,
your sweet little babe,
your sweet little babe.
Honey and the rock and the sugar don't stop. Gonna bring a bottle to the baby. Don't you weep, pretty babe.
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 She's long gone with her red shoes on. Gonna need another loving babe. Go to sleep, little babe.
Go to sleep, little babe.
Go to sleep, little babe.
Go to sleep, little babe.
You and me and the devil makes three. Don't need no other loving babe. Go to sleep, little babe.
Go to sleep, little babe.
Go to sleep, little babe.
Go to sleep, little babe.
Come.